ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's alliance with the United States has been the linchpin of our country's foreign policy for decades.
We value the unbroken friendship between the Australian and the American peoples.
But between the wars and the tariffs and the unpredictability, are we growing apart?
You know who else didn't help us? Australia!
Join me, Hamish McDonald.
And me, Geraldine Doogue, as we ask, do we still need the alliance? Search for Global Roaming on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Meredith Lake. It is great to be with you for Soul Search, the show about spirituality on ABC Radio National and Radio Australia. I love a sunburnt country, a land of sweeping plains. Did you learn that line at school from Dorothea McKellar's Celebration of the Landscape? I sure did. And surely it's up there as one of the best known lines of poetry ever written about Australia. But more than a century after the sunburnt country, how are contemporary poets giving voice to place? I'm asking the question from Central Australia, from Arunda country in Umbantwa Alice Springs, and I'm in the company of a red dirt poet and poetry champion, the incomparable Laurie May. Laurie is the executive director of Red Dirt Poetry, a publisher and a festival curator, and Laurie's own journey as a poet began when Ujuru Nunukul paid a visit to her primary school in Queensland back in the day. Hello, Laurie.
Hi, Meredith. How are you?
Great. We're going to talk about poetry and about how poetry is bound up with the places where it's written, read, performed, and heard. And I guess my big question is, how does place matter to you?
Place matters to me a lot. I write a lot about my experiences of, you know, family and growing up, you know, in the northernmost part of Queensland, and then, you know, working my way down the coast and then moving to Darwin and then living in Central Australia for 14 years. A lot of my work is inherently tied up with this place and where I live and, you know, living on Gap Road and being part of that community that we have here. So the current, and I won't talk too much about it because I got so many other poets to talk about, not just myself, but I'm working on a collection called Eating the Equinox, which is going to be my first published collection, chronicling a year of living literally in the gap in this little space that we've kind of in community we've created, and all the food that I'm growing, all the recipes that I'm cooking, and how those things are intrinsically linked to memory and existence.
Wow. For people who don't know what the gap is, how would you shake out the gap?
Oh, how would I shake it out? It's the entryway into the township of Alice Springs. You pass through when you get off the airport, you know, when you're driving through, you pass through this beautiful, you know, gap in the ranges.
Yeah, it's and a literal gap.
It's
isn't
a literal,
it?
It's very literal. And then that's the main road, Gap Road, that takes you into the town. And we're sort of on the outskirts, closer to those beautiful ranges that I get to look at. The Andoree ranges outside my bathroom window, brushing my teeth, I get to see the ranges. I go to bed, I see the ranges. It's beautiful.
Can you tell me more about your process of writing from this place?
Well, at the moment, because of what I'm writing is tied in with different, you know, pagan, with different pagan elements, with different local weather elements, with different climate conditions and food. So often what I'm writing about is starts with an ingredient. So it starts with something I've grown in the garden. So I might pick a cabbage and then sort of form something around that. Or the piece that I've been working on, and it's still very raw, is about this hominy pie. And so I was thinking about leeks and kale, because that's what I've got a lot of growing in the garden. And so I was picking the leeks and the kales and created this recipe, my version of a hominy pie, and then it sort of sparked this memory of my grandmother passed away a couple of months ago. And so I'd always wanted to write her a poem and I couldn't. And so that the food actually unlocked that poem. So even though it's not about this place, it's still got that connection to it in terms of that I literally pulled the poem out of the ground.
Wow. How did you become a poet?
How did I become a poet? That is a good question. I think I've always written poetry. My mum always finds little excerpts from school books and stuff and takes photos and sends them to me. So I remember when you were 8, you wrote this. So I think I've always written poetry. I remember, and I've told the story a million times before, but I was very fortunate when I was like 7 to meet Udru Noonuckle before.
Did you?
Yeah, which was really, really cool.
How did that happen?
She came to our school, which was really weird. I think I went to a really cool school. And so I was sitting there and listening to this woman talk and, you know, of being of Aboriginal descent and hearing this Aboriginal woman talk about all these empowering things made me feel really special, because obviously we got teased a lot at school. And so I was like, oh, wow, I could do this and I could have this space. And my mum tells that story of me running home and being like, you're not going to believe this. I met this woman and now I'm going to write poetry. So that's kind of how it started.
Wow.
But I didn't really think I could perform poetry or in public or share with anyone until I was living in Darwin. Oh, this was a long time ago, and we were reading poetry for people who were incarcerated in detention centres coming in from, you know, other countries. And so we would stand below on the footpath and yell poetry at people to be entertaining, I guess. And so that was when I first was like, oh, I could read poem in front of someone. So.
Mm. I mean, we have a lot of debates, and you've written about this. To what extent do we need poetry, or is it a luxury, an add-on to our lives, to our communities? I mean, that example strikes me as very political, as engaged with those wider structural questions. Mm. What do you see as the role of poetry from this place or from these lands in that kind of structural sense?
I think it's really important that stories from regional areas are shared and heard, and that our voices are just as you know, relevant as mainstream urban areas or mainstream Australian voices, and that we've got a really rich history here that a lot of people don't know about. And I think that's I've gone through ebbs and flows with poetry where I'm like, oh, it is a luxury, I don't have time for it. You know, because I'm trying to survive, and obviously coming from, you know, a lower socioeconomic background and still, you know, being in one, it is one of those things you're like, oh, do I prioritize writing a poem today, or do I prioritize, you know, finding some
working
money
for a wage?
Yeah. But I think I've got to the point now in my life where I'm like, look, I'd rather be poor and happy and write poetry and share those stories.
Wow. That's a big call.
Yeah.
I think a lot of artists face that question, and all of us, can we monetize what matters most to us at the end of the day? These are the existential questions we're all asking right now.
Yeah, which is, you know, one of the reasons why we've established Red Dirt Poetry as an organization is because we want to find ways to support poets to have access to, even though it's not a regular income, but to have access to you know, benefits that you might get in an urban area. We've started a press as well, which is really cool, and we've published our first book. And so there's not a lot of money in book publishing, obviously, but look, anything is better than nothing, and we're really proud of the book that we've got out, and it's selling really well.
So Red Dirt Poetry is, it's a festival, mm-hmm. it's an imprint or a publisher now, it's a community. What is your vision for Red Dirt Poetry, and why Red Dirt in particular?
So we really want to support regional Australia, and we've got this beautiful red dirt, which isn't just here in Central Australia. It's all over the place. Melanie Munangar and I were up in Nhulunbuy running poetry workshops in the school there, and it's got that beautiful red dirt. You know, if you go down to central, you know, across to central Queensland or central South Australia, you are surrounded by all this beautiful red dirt, which makes our country. And so we sort of started with that idea of, like, what if we could find a way to support regional poets Australia wide, not just the Northern Territory, and kind of get that reach out there. So we have monthly poetry nights, we have events. So we're trying to do a lot. And as an operationally unfunded organisation, we certainly do jam a lot into a calendar year, into an annual program. And we're really proud of that.
The first book from Red Dirt Poetry, the first publication, comes from here. Tell me a little bit about Marie Ellis's book.
This was really important that we started with Marie Elena Ellis's book, I Am the Desert. Marie Elena Ellis is a poet from Amungana. She is Aranda and Walpiri poet and writes a lot about desert landscapes, about culture, connection to country and language and family as well. It's a really beautiful collection. It's also got QR codes in it. We recorded 10 of the, or 11, I think, 10 or 11, I can't remember, of the poems with soundscapes from Dan the Underdog. So you can actually, if you do want to use your phone, you can scan the QR code and then you can listen to that poem being read to you.
Wow. You've obviously got the big picture of poetic writing across so much of the continent. What else is exciting you in regional poetry writing at the moment?
There's so much poetry at the moment. I mean, we just ran a whole festival for it, so, you know.
Why do you think that is? Like, why is there a lot of poetry at the moment? It seems to me that there is a resurgence or a renaissance in the poetic form right now, and I wonder why you think, do you see that, or why do you think it is?
Definitely. I do think it has a lot to do with that kind of backlash against technology and that idea that we can sit there and, you know, ascribe meaning to our lives and the world outside of this sort of space. And also it forces you to sort of get out of that 30-second algorithmic sort of mindset that I know a lot of us have been trapped into. And also it's really hard to write good poetry with AI technologies. I know, because you can tell when somebody's used you know, an AI, a generative text to write a poem, you're like, nah. So, and I think we're seeing a lot more different styles of poetry. We're seeing people playing with form. We're seeing people kind of have more narrative structures within their works than we ever have before. And we're starting to see less perfection. And I think that is that we're going to maybe in 100 years' time look back at the poetry of this time and be like, what sets this apart? And it is this, you know, backlash.
Right. Mm. And so what are you reading? What are you loving? Talk to me about it.
So many things at the moment.
I've asked you the impossible question.
Well, I am currently absolutely in love with this book called Home Between the Cedar Trees by Jahad Yassin, who was here for the Red Dirt Poetry Festival. Jahad is from a regional part of New South Wales. I'm not very familiar with New South Wales, so somewhere down there, somewhere. And it's a really, honestly, it's a stunning book. He's only young, but as I say to everyone, he writes with such knowledge and grace and beauty. I've never read anything like it at all. So it's this, he's a young Lebanese writer from regional New South Wales, and he writes a lot about family and religion, so spirituality is in there as well, and the environment. So it's got sections around the garden and trees and mountains, and it's just, yeah. Honestly, this is a book that I cry every time I read it.
In a good way.
In a good way. Like, it will make you cry. Like, it's really beautiful. Mm. Yep. Sit by the fire, glass of red wine or a hot chocolate, and, read this book.
Wow.
Mm.
You've got brought a small library here, Laurie.
I have. A book that I've been banging on a lot about Trials of Hope recently. So this is Yerga Gellow-Waldyes. He's from Perth, which I know is not regional Australia, but, like, it's pretty far away.
I think for a lot of people, Perth counts as far away.
It does.
Sorry, Perth.
But we love your poetry. And so this book is really amazing because the poetry in it is written in English and Amharic, and then the narrative within it, you know, is written as narrative nonfiction, and it's all about his life and his journey and going through that upheaval from civil war in Ethiopia to coming to Australia, and he just writes so beautifully. It starts from him being, you know, a young child running through the mountains, and it's just, I can't recommend this book enough. It's called Trials of Hope. Yeah, I'm also reading Luke Patterson's A Savage Turn. So this is really, it's really interesting. It's really cool. He's a young Aboriginal poet from, where's the Murray, darling?
Well, South Australia, a bit of Victoria. It's big.
Down that way somewhere.
South. Yes, definitely south.
You can tell that I'm from Weipa. I don't know, anywhere below the Queensland border. But this is a really, really stunning collection. And, like, I know that I can't show the readers, but you can see here in how the structure of the poem has been formed that it it really throws out like a traditional, I guess, format of stanzas and style, and it's opting for a much more dynamic view on the page. And so how you read it is how it's written, and it changes the way that you like intake that. The other book I do, look, I love, and I'm probably saying his name wrong, so I do apologise, but it's Dimitri Chalumas, an older Greek-Australian poet, and I fell in love with his work in, I might have been in grade five. I was a weird kid. And his Rhapsody of Old Men, which was, you know, about his experience in the war and surviving and survivor's guilt. And I loved it. And so I've got here a collection called The Harbour, which doesn't have that poem in it, unfortunately. But this is also really beautiful and talks about environment, rivers, landscapes, and it's got that deep pain of the author in there as well that I think is really reflective in all of his work. So those are the sort of like, there's my sort of top five at the moment. It might change next week, but here's my top five.
Well, to come back to this place, to Central Australia, to Aranda country, perhaps even to the Gap, what would be lost if we didn't write out of this place? Or read out of this place, or hear out of this place?
That is a very good question. I think, and you know, I don't want to, I'm kind of paraphrasing something Marie said during the opening of Red Dirt Poetry Festival, was that this is the beating heart of Australian poetry. Like Central Australia in particular is the heart of the country. We're not a throwaway. We're not an afterthought. We're not a, you know, political battlefield. We are the heart of this country, and that our words and our poetry, the idea is that we hope to be sending those ripples out across, and it's, you know, represented in the landscape as well. You know, when you're flying over and you can see it almost looks like the sand's got the waves to it, and then going out into the ocean where you've got the waves as well. So it's this whole concept of connection and continuity, in that the waves kind of ripple out, and then we also bring the waves back in as well when we bring other poets into our space and into our home. And so it's that idea of the beating heart represented in those waves. Does that, I don't know if that makes sense. I might be a little too poetic.
Well, I guess, yeah. Who wants to be part of a heartless community?
Exactly. Exactly.
We want to be part of a community with heart, wherever we find that, or wherever we're able to contribute or build something towards that. And it sounds like poetry is certainly one way in which that beat comes alive. Radio National is counting down, or needs everyone's input to help count down the 100 best Australian books of all time. And I think that reaction you just had is the one that the entire nation is feeling right now, Laurie. It's impossible. You mentioned Ujuru Nunnuckle. Obviously, that was a really formative encounter for you. But I wonder, is there one book? It might not be your actual favourite this week, but one book you think we need to recall or remember or at least consider as we all look down the barrel of choosing and voting for our favourite Australian book? Your time starts now.
Oh, my goodness. How would I decide? I mean,
it's terrifying, isn't it?
It is terrifying. And I'm just like, all of a sudden, I can't think of a single book that exists in the world. I'm like, nah, not a book is real. When I was little, my great-grandmother gave me a book called Seven Little Australians.
Ethel Turner. And you read it?
I did read it, yeah. I was a very well-read kid. I spent a lot of time at the library. I didn't really like being at home. And so being at the library was really good. So I did read a lot. But Seven Little Australians was one that stuck out for me. I can't remember. It might be problematic now. I was like eight when I read it. And then I'm thinking, like, you know, in high school we were all forced to read Looking for Ella Brandy.
Melina Marchetta.
And yeah, that was an exceptional book. So I'm kind of like torn, but I'm also thinking Trials of Hope by Jurga Geller-Waldyes.
These are the dilemmas we all face, but what a great snapshot of a little bit of an insight into your own reading life.
Absolutely. Yeah, there you go. But I might need to do some research and text you back through my answer once I've gone and back and reread every single Australian book ever.
Yeah, I think that's the task for the whole country between now and the end of September. I think voting's open till the very early October, but people can go and do that. You can go and do that. I'll go and do that. But Laurie, thank you so much for reminding me of those books and introducing me to some of these new writers who I didn't know about, who I would now love to go and read, and for sharing that beating heart of poetry here in Central Australia. Thank you so much.
No worries. Thank you so much for having me.
Laurie May, the Executive Director of Red Dirt Poetry here in Mbantwa Alice Springs, and the Artistic Director of the biennial Red Dirt Poetry Festival. And yes, now's the time to work out your votes in Radio National's Top 100 Australian Books. Head to the Radio National website for all the details. You can choose up to 10 titles. But before you go and do that, Laurie May is also a poet, and this is a very special sneak peek at a poem from their forthcoming book.
This poem is called Autumn Equinox on Stolen Land, and this is yet to be published from the Eating the Equinox collection. When summer breaks, we celebrate Mabon, feast in the dregs of sun-hardened crops. The dried corn is ground, put in the damper. The first fire of the year is lit, carefully baked in the coals, and when cool enough, spread with jam made from mulberry and kwandong or honey fresh from the hive. The equinox brings hope, life to the desert. We pull the vines down, turn the last of the loofah into sponges to scrub the shame from skin all year long. Rest pumpkins in the sun to cure, prepare the soil for autumn and winter crops. Dig fingers deep into the ground, desperate to feel connection to land that is not ours, but holds us despite the fact.
Autumn Equinox on Stolen Land, written and read by poet Laurie May. And you can look out for that in print in Laurie's forthcoming book, Eating the Equinox. On Radio National, Radio Australia, and anytime with ABC Listen, it's Meredith Lake here with you, and we're talking poetry on Soul Search today. What does poetry have to do with place, and how might it open upon the sacred? Mark Tredenick is a multi-award-winning poet and essayist, and he's based in the Southern Highlands of New South Wales. At least for now, though, he's in an ABC studio, which I know can feel a little placeless, more airport lounge than poetic inspiration. But all the same, Mark, I want to know how place matters to you, and especially to your writing of poetry.
Oh, that's a good question. I'm a poet and indeed a prose writer who's very almost addicted to writing from the actual place I'm in. I find it actually quite hard not to include the place that I'm sitting in, which would be tricky right now, as you allude to, because this is kind of an unplace in a way. And so that it's actually a bit of a constraint on my trade, I find, when I'm in a room without windows, without an actual relationship with light and, you know, tree and so on. But I'm usually somewhere like my desk in the house, in the studio of the house at Bower or Gunungurra country where I live. And I'm in the light of that place and in the history of that place. We write and live downstream of history. We fish our phrases from the stream, I have in one of my poems. And I think I'm always in that. I'm in connection with a larger kind of place. I'm aware, if that's the place I'm writing in, that I'm also in, for example, Gunungurra country, which is drained by the Windjarra River, and I'm in the Great Divide. Those are kind of elements of my deeper awareness, I think, if I'm writing anywhere around that sort of space. But then I'll be, say I'm writing a poem, which I was recently, about the Brumbies, because it appalls me.
And what appalls you?
Oh, the killing appalls me. I can't. It breaks my heart. And so writing that poem, I threw my imagination into the light and the air and the weather of the high downs of that landscape and the edges of the forest. And I was helped in that case by some photography. I will be conjuring a place, and it will have physical sense. It will have spatial qualities. It will have textural qualities. It will have a quality of light and air and weather and birdsong. And I think I'll be aware of those things in the making of the work.
What is it in a place that is so... well, grounding. I mean, you've mentioned light several times. And it intrigues me because, I mean, where I live here in Central Australia, the way the light transforms a place from moment to moment is like nothing I've really encountered before. And I think it explains why in Central Australia the depth and richness of creative life is what it is. In writing, in visual arts, in dance, in song. It's as if people for tens of thousands of years have been unable to do anything but make and create in response to it.
Yeah, I think that's...
So what is it about light? What is the quality of light?
Well, it's
for you?
It's space, it's breath, it's spirit. If the ground is soul, we might come back to these terms because they're tricky, aren't they? But, you know, terrain matters a great deal. Sense of elevation, although that too is a sense of being in the air, you know, kind of off the ground. But I suppose the light is like the character. It's also like the breath. It's like the anima, you know, of the experience of being somewhere. Our heads are up in it. Our feet are on the surface of the ground or near the surface of the ground. Yeah, I was a bit intrigued that I said light so often in response to your question there, but it's very much alive for me. I go to the dog park most mornings there in Bowral on Centennial Avenue, and inevitably somebody complains about the weather, and inevitably Mark Tredinnick replies with, "Oh, but the light." And isn't maybe the cold the price of the light? And I go, "Oh, but it feels so cold." And I'm going, "It's not about you, you know." The weather is about itself. A place is about itself, and we get the gift of being in it. And if we're uncomfortable, then go inside or find someone to hug or put some more clothes on or something. Mm. But, so light's important. And terroir, you know, that lovely term that's used among winemakers, stolen from the French, for all the attributes of a place somewhere, including the light, of course, and the pattern of the weather and the rainfall pattern and the nature of the structures of the soil and how well it drains and all of that kind of stuff feeds into the character that we observe as a consumer of wine in the wine and as a maker of the wine. The winemaker is very concerned to respect those qualities that are present and induce them in the product that they're making, in that case, wine. And I've made a haiku, a little poem out of this. I think it goes, wine is how you stop grapes becoming vinegar. Same thing with love. That's how my poem goes. But the human intervention, so the art practice to make a dance or to make a wine or to make a poem or a story, is an act of respect for that which is innate in the place historically in bird terms and all sorts of terms, and then to make a response that carries that respect forward and kind of heightens, I guess, the qualities, intensifies the qualities that are more loosely present in the place. And that's coffee and that's wine. You know, you put pressure on the grounds in order to intensify the flavor, and the winemaker uses what they know about, you know, the pressure that you put on the product that goes into to make it intoxicating, interestingly enough. And of course, yes, a poem, like a good place, is supposed to be intoxicating.
Mark, you have written somewhere, I read this somewhere, about poetry as a way of rendering the ordinary epiphanies of life. And as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking of that and also of the way poets like Les Murray and so many others have kind of lent into the sacramental quality of ordinary life and in wine speaks of sacrament to me in all kinds of ways. It's more than a metaphor, is what I'm saying. Can you elaborate on that? And what is a poem then? Is it a kind of winemaking? Is it an intensifying of something divine even?
Of course, the idiom of poetry is metaphor, really, is trope. So you're coming at things slant, as Emily Dickinson beautifully puts it, in order to both intensify something that you want to carry forward to someone else, and also to give them a way in. That's what the slantness is about, to give them some work to do, as with that, you know, haiku of mine, or as with one that might go, what was the one I had the other morning? In a warming world, each cold dawn is forgiveness, ice on the pond. And so,
oh,
you know,
Mark. Would you read that again?
In a warming world, each cold dawn is forgiveness, ice on the pond. Mm. It's just so that's an example, really, I think, of a poem as a practice and my sense of its utility, because I do have a very Protestant sense, I think, of the utility.
Repent, no.
Of the work. No, not so much that.
Tell me more about that. What is, why did you raise that now? Why is that like one of the wellsprings for your writing? Because I know you do have preachers in your family history, and I think in general, this is perhaps a thought bubble that I shouldn't speak out loud, but there is a Protestant cast to a lot of what we take to be Australian secular culture. And I am curious about that and how that might land in your own writing.
I've got another angle on that, Meredith, but we'll come back to that. But I think specifically for me, mine is a tradition poetically, artistically, that goes back to, well, I'm going to say Luther, really, but specifically
<That's okay. laughs>
Charles Wesley, really. It's a very, it's a dissenting tradition, and I take my dissent very seriously.
It's a singing tradition too.
And it's a singing tradition. So you have the lyric, and you have the independence of thought, and you have the obligation to engage with that which is divine or sacred or this, you know, thou, in some sense, personally, without the intervention of priests. And so I'm very nervous about gatekeepers in life. The cultural gatekeepers trouble the hell out of me, because it's critical that each of us learns the craft of, as it were, metaphorically, for now, prayer, and that we have that devotion, that devotional practice one-on-one with the creation. Mary Oliver's coming to mind as I say that, for you too.
Yes.
And you know, so I'd be kin with her kind of way, the way she had of being in the world, which wanted to find that which sustained one, but also that was in some loose sense godly in ordinary moments, and to do something useful with that gift that you've been given to encounter it. And the useful thing might be to make a poem or an essay, and then you're still not finished with being useful, because the utility has to be musically useful. It has to practice a lyric tradition of being and of seeing and of saying that stands the risk of improving somebody's life and reconnecting them with the lyric frequencies of existence, is how I sometimes think. Of course, the Methodist tradition is a social democratic tradition as well, essentially. It's social work with hymn singing is how I kind of think of my tradition. So it's very dedicated to usefulness, to the improvement of others' lives. And I think I grew up with maybe even an excessive sense that the person whose troubles mattered was not you. It was someone else, and that your work was, like I think of my grandma in that connection. Her work was a tireless mission of helping those less well-off than herself, those kind of that pattern of engagement with community, doing some good and doing it through. If singing was the gift you had, then do it and make it good and get good at it, not for the sake of your fame, but for the sake of the work of reconnection with, you know, that which is holy, which is the work of poetry as well as hymn singing.
On ABC Radio National, by podcast with ABC Listen, and across the Pacific on Radio Australia. You're listening to Soul Search. I'm Meredith Lake, and I guess I'm exploring what might be sacred
about the poetic here on this ancient continent we call Australia. I'm in the company of Mark Tredenick. And Mark, I've got a lot to ask you, given what you've already said. But in a nutshell, why do you think we need poetry? Like, does it matter for our spirit, for our souls, whatever set of metaphors you want to engage there?
Yeah. Sometimes I put it this way, Meredith, because I have thought quite hard about the importance of language and the importance of kind of right speech and right rhythm and so on. At a time like this, when you can look at it and say it's too late for all of that kind of, you know, finessing. We're trying to survive here. We're trying to push back against climate change and tyrants and whatnot. But I think we are the languaging beings. I think we are beings who language and who live, like if I can use it loosely as a verb, and for whom language is that important. Now, the more we find out about the other beings, the more it seems they might be our very close kin in this respect.
Yes.
But there is a way in which language matters for humans, perhaps arguably, well, language of the kind we're engaged in now and language of the kind of written kind matters more, as far as we know, for us than for any other beings, than my horses, for example. They've got a different pattern of interconnection, a bit different access to the truth and so on. But when it comes down to it, language with each other with a few whinnies and some kicks in the side and bites in the neck and running around.
It's not metaphor. So
it's not metaphor. No, but for us, it's a literal thing. It matters to the quality of our lives, I would say, that we are in languaging relationships of one kind or another. And so therefore, I think we're all better individually and socially, like at large, when the quality of the languaging is better. And that's a complex question, but I'll give you a quick example of it. Like, I spent too much time yesterday in the languaging of university administration. And honestly, Meredith, the older I get, the more visceral my horror is of that experience. Like, I almost can't read it. It has no humanity in it that's discernible, you know, turns of phrase that refer to cohorts and passive voice and terrible punctuation. And it's a dehuman discourse. And I think it does damage, particularly to those of us who are sensitive, but worse still, it does damage to those people who just become accustomed to it, because then we live in a swill of language that's kind of ugly, discordant, doesn't value us in our selfhood. It values segments of market and, you know, power relations and so on.
And even just content rather than stories, you know?
Yeah.
I find that one triggering.
So I found, yes, you would, exactly. And, you know, and I find triggering the kind of complete lack of care for cadence and for a beautiful kind of economy. So I'm not going to waste my reader's time as far as I can by repeating myself or uttering some platitude or using a piece of language for something I'm talking about that could be better said with less. Mm. So I'm not going to say, you know, utilization. I'm going to say use.
I mean, wasn't that Mark Twain? If I'd had more time, this would have been shorter.
That's, yeah. I know.
And I mean, the challenge of writing briefly is extreme, I think. And that's partly why poetry is so hard won.
Yeah.
For those who write it.
And so valuable for those who read it because of that, Meredith. You know, if it's done even half well or three quarters well, then it delivers up way more than it seems to, and it keeps on delivering. I sometimes describe a poem as a soft bomb. Like, it's something, it's incendiary and it goes off and it keeps going off, but the work that it does is not to deny life, but to celebrate life, even to fashion new thought and animation and everything. So, and it only gets to do that if the poet practices the crafts that I think nature teaches us, to get back to place too, how to practice, you know, getting a lot done with a little and not wasting anything and getting on with your neighbours and all of that stuff. Yeah.
It's a practice that must be sustainable in that sense, or at least within the weave of the ordinary natural world.
Yeah, that's right.
I often find myself thinking about Les Murray's poem, Religions Are Poems, partly because that poem articulates our need for poetry in relation to the life of the spirit
in such an extraordinary way, I think. And he says, there'll always be religion around while there is poetry, or a lack of it. And I wonder how you would shake out that relationship for in your experience as a writer. Is there something religious about writing or reading poetry for you?
Yeah, definitely. I don't have too much embarrassment saying that I think, frankly, poetry is a spiritual practice, and it meets the same needs in humans that religions attempt to and sometimes manage to do. And then how do we characterize that need exactly?
Yes.
Spiritual gets at it quite closely, but I think it's about a profound sense of the fit between your life, yourself, and where and when you find yourself, like a deep fit. And I think it's episodic, because there are moments when that happens to each of us, I suspect, and we think this, here, now, home, is kind of the feeling, and then it'll shift because, you know, you've got to pay the tax man or...
But that was the epiphany.
But that was the epiphany. And then poetry and religion, I think, give us ways to get back more often to epiphanies, to recognize them when we see them, and to have access to them in our lives through other people's experiences of, you know, ordinary epiphanies, I suppose. And then I think also that business of taking yourself into epiphanies is largely grace, but we earn the grace, as it were, by disciplines, by teaching our eyes to see and our ears to listen, and going back to school a bit on geography and geology so that we can be more attentive to strata and all of that. Some wonderful words on that from Norman MacLean, who wrote that great book, A River Runs Through It. It's a memoir, really, where Norman says, all good things come by grace, and grace comes by art, and art does not come easy. Isn't that good? The first part of that, I think, is beautiful too, because you can invite the epiphany, and then it turns out that they're everywhere all the time, trying to find you, but you can invite it a bit by the what he calls the art. And art of all kinds entails discipline and learning and scholarship and mastery and apprenticeship and all that kind of stuff. And then everything that you write that's any good, like any act you ever perform that's any good in the world, you realize that you didn't do it on your own.
What we're talking about, in a way, is a habituated life that's structured around repeated practices that become arts. Mary Oliver has a great line about habit being formative, and the religious literally wear it. But in a place like this, to come back to this, who are the poets that have spoken to you or that you see yourself in some kind of kinship with in that sense?
That's such a good question, and I'm wishing I had my list in front of me now. But Mary Oliver is one of them. Keats and Hopkins... So think of the religion there. It's not obvious with Keats, is it? But he was, in fact, a dissenter. I'm very proud of my connection in that way.
And Mary Oliver, too, was very influenced by the, you know, the transcendentalists, Emerson, and, you know, and who, were very open to the ordinary epiphanies of life.
That's it. It's a kind of those people who are what I would call plain-spoken mystics, are my people.
Okay.
And like Charles Wesley was probably one of them, now that I think about it. But I think plainspoken's a large school, because I'm thinking of Rumi and the Ecstatics also in that kind of area. And I think Charles Wright, the American practitioner, still with us, Gary Snyder maybe, a lot of the American Midwesterners, because you've got that transcendental thing coming through into the arts in America more than you had it here. I think we get romanticism secondhand here, and romanticism has always struck me as being a bit of a secondhand transcendentalism, because transcendentalism was so kind of robustly connected to environment and place and trees and woods and stuff, and it's a little bit more effete in Wordsworth and Keats, much as I love him. But beauty is truth. Truth, beauty, that is all you know on earth and all you need to know.
Ode on a Grecian urn.
Well, Keats and Hopkins were my two HSC poets. And it's very interesting. You could plot my course in life from that moment, I recognised them straight away as kin. I didn't really encounter too many of the Chinese and Japanese poets, like the classicists like Du Fu and Li Bai, until more recently. Another one I should mention is Robert Gray, of course, who was a mentor for me. He never really put himself in that role, although I think in a way he did. Robert was inclined to find people from time to time whose work needed help or whatever, and just lean in and offer a bit of guidance. Robert did that a bit. And actually, going back before him, I found my way to Robert when I was still about 17 or 18 in church at the Chester Street Uniting Church in Epping, which was a congregational congregation, actually, after Union. And Jim Tulip was at that church. And a lot of people would know Jim Tulip, James Tulip, from his teaching at Sydney University in the English department. But it was my luck and a bit of a sign of calling that he heard me. I think he heard me give a eulogy in the church for my grandmother when she passed. And he said, "Show me some of your work, Mark." And that's one of those moments, you know. Mm. And so I did. And what he said in return was economical. He just said, "Good, you need to read some Robert Gray and you need to read some William Carlos Williams," one of his best known poems, which you probably know, goes, "Everything depends on the red wheelbarrow sitting in the bottom of the garden and glazed with rain." That's the poem and everything. But he had a proposition that said, "No ideas, but in things." No ideas, but in things. In other words, lodge in a poem any thesis statement you might want to make inside an image that will bear it, and then pull out all the protestation if you can. And of course, that does describe good poetry practice across the ages and the cultures pretty well, doesn't it?
Mm. You've also described poetry as deep speech.
Mm.
I wonder how you read our moment now. Where are we when it comes to the deep speech of the spiritual here in Australia?
I'm an eternal, inexhaustible optimist, really, though I do grumble a lot about some things and maintain a teaching practice because there's a risk that we might lose some things of value, I think, particularly the importance of recollecting other people's poetries, indigenous and, you know, Confucian and so on, and that wisdom might be lost because current concerns are so compelling to us. Ideological concerns, for example, with identity can be quite rich, but don't go as deep as concerns with self and place and soul. And there's a tendency and a risk, I suppose, that the concerns of poetry might become, in my view, too narrowly social and political, and fail to respect the kind of mysteries of existence, sometimes experienced in grief and ecstasy, for example, that are deeply human and universal, I think, and therefore profoundly important to maintain our connection to. I think reading widely and asking yourself to speak deeply. So the depth, what I mean by deep speech in that phrase, is about the content, as it were, but it's also about the modality. It's about the mode of doing the speaking. So it's writing, I think I sometimes say, is more like chant than chatter. Chant, not chatter, but chant. You push too far down the chant line and you're back in church, I guess, or Gregorian era, and that's not what I mean. So it's more like chant than chatter. And of course, that gets us back to why poetry matters, because it has always been, it always has served the purpose of enchantment, of re-enchantment sometimes, of its subject matter and of its readers. And that's well performed when the poet remembers to respect those elements of the acts of speech that aren't just reducible to content, but are there because something mysterious is articulated in the rhythm structure and the beauty or strikingness of the speech music, you know, that's employed. And, you know, it's as though, I think, it's a bit of a mystical notion, but I have a sense that we're shepherding, or some of us are called to keep alive some conditions of existence, and that enrich life. We're back to enchantment, I suppose. Yeah. And poetry's part in that is not quite the same as song, and it's not quite the same as story. It's somewhere in the middle. We have to have content, and the kind of content that we want will be attentive to the textures of daily life and human behavior and speech, like story. But narrative doesn't drive it, you see. Lyric drives it. A poem is like a pond, not a river, I sometimes say, or a chain of ponds. And the discontinuities and the smallness are important somehow to human existence, because I think life is like that. Each life tends to be, like when you look back, you see the river, but at the time you're in a pond, and then you're in the dirt, and then you're in the pond. And so poetry sort of seems to me to recognize that, and it sings up that which is not always beautiful, actually, but sort of divine and life-threatening and incredible and deathly and exquisite. Emily Dickinson says, "Life is a spell so exquisite that everything conspires to break it." Isn't that good? And, of course, it is frequently broken, and arguably it has to be broken. You can't cook for the kids and, you know, earn a living if you're perpetually in the stream of the exquisite. But we do need to recast the spell, and poetry is in that space, I think.
Well, on that note, Mark, I'm going to ask you an impossible question.
Great.
You may have heard rumours, which I can confirm are true, that Radio National is going to be counting down the best 100 Australian books as chosen by listeners. And I wonder if there's a book that comes to your mind as one that must be discussed, that must be considered, that you think deserves a place in the best Australian books of all time.
Oh, definitely. Creekwater Journal by Robert Gray.
Tell me more. Why do you love it?
There you go. Well, you know, it's partly that's for personal reasons, because it was the book of his I read when I was led by Jim Tulip to discover myself more deeply. And because he said, go read some Robert Gray, and that was the one that I found. It was the most recent book, I think, of his, just out in the 70s sometime. And it taught me, and it teaches others, how to be someone other than a First Nations person, actually, and yet find a connection to country, you might say, or place, and come back from that encounter with some plain-spoken, very plain-spoken, contemporaneous languaging for it that does justice to what it might feel like to be living in a place, in that place or some such place, as a human, as a languaging being at that time. I learned those lessons from that book and stopped trying to sound like Wordsworth on the page. And I think it's still capable of teaching people of all cuts and colours and castes, I think, those kind of lessons of deep, ordinary, not too up yourself belonging.
Mark, thank you. That's a great recommendation. And thank you for just giving me a little glimpse into your own life and thought and practice as a poet, attempting those very same things. It's been a real wonder to have this conversation with you today.
It's a privilege for me too, Meredith. I really appreciate it. So thanks.
Mark Tredenick, whose own poetry has won him numerous major awards, he was recommending Robert Gray's Creekwater Journal as his favourite Australian book. Is there an Australian book that you love? Which books have meant the most to you? Will there be poetry in the mix when you cast your vote in Radio National's Top 100 Australian Books? Voting is open now, so head to the Radio National website and begin the delicious task of browsing and deciding your favourite books. Earlier on Soul Search, you heard from Laurie May, the director of Red Dirt Poetry here in Central Australia. And I hope that, like me, you've enjoyed ranging across these big questions of place, poetry and the sacred. You can listen again with the Soul Search podcast and follow Soul Search on ABC Listen. There's more poetry coming your way in our next episode, as well as a wonderful meditation on friendship. For now, thanks to producers Rowan Salmond and Hong Jiang. My name's Meredith Lake, and I'll catch you next time on Radio National, Radio Australia, and with ABC Listen.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.